Welcome to Bee's Table Talk, the podcast in which we have great conversations about business and our economy. My name is Bee Kyle, President and CEO of the St. Paul Area Chamber, and I'm glad you've joined us. I always enjoy these conversations. It's my chance to talk with leaders among us who are doing great things within the community and within their organizations. Today, we are talking about leadership within the entrepreneurial ecosystem. I've known my next guest for a few years now. In fact, he's been with the Chamber and on our Ambassadors Committee since before I joined in 2017. Nels Larson is an entrepreneur and is the owner of Guidance Accounting, LLC. He works with small businesses and their owners to help minimize income taxes, provide tax return preparation and planning, and encourages them to think about the big picture, including their exit strategy. Nels has a degree in economics from, as he calls it, the Harvard of the Midwest, the St. Cloud State University. He is a CPA and has lived in St. Paul for over 2 years. He also has his own podcast, so he'll be giving me some tips along the way, the Guidance Accounting Podcast. So this will be fun. I'd like to introduce you to Nels Larson. Nels, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Bee. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Nels. What inspired you to start your own company and how did you get roped into the St. Paul Area Chamber? We've been a beneficiary of your energy for a while. We're really grateful.
Well, I had worked for a couple larger CPA firms, and while I really enjoyed my time with them and learned a ton, I didn't want to be so much of a hired gun. I wanted to have my own clients and my own practice, and I wanted to have the ability to kind of sculpt or create more of my own future. You know, part of that was wanting to be a little bit of a digital nomad so I could work. And this is pre-COVID, you know, obviously 5 years ago, you know, where the idea of working from a home office was something that very few people had experienced. And the idea of being able to work wherever I was, as long as my brain was functioning, I had the technology to support it, was very appealing to me.
So we need to pause on that for a moment. So I wasn't aware of that. Have you been virtual as a business since you started the organization?
You know, since I started my practice 5 years ago, I've not had a permanent office outside of the home. I have worked with a couple of great co-working organizations that were both chamber members, Wellworth in downtown St. Paul and the Reserve. But I didn't have dedicated office space at either one. It was just a place to meet and land between meetings. And prior, you know, just about the time COVID hit, I went 100% virtual. And I have not really met with a client since then. Zoom is a great tool, phone calls, and as I said earlier, before we started recording, I've got a face made for radio. So people seem to be just as happy to be able to talk with me over the phone as they are to see me in person. And when you think about it, I don't know if I'm ever adding value to a client by driving to their location. Although having said that, I do find value when I start working with someone, if they have an operation, if they are making widgets or whatever they might produce, I think that there is value in kind of seeing the business and how it operates.
But that makes sense.
Outside of that, I don't know that, you know, myself or a client spending half an hour to an hour in round trip, you know, stair time commuting, you know, to a location necessarily adds a lot of value to my clients and relationships.
So you can build your rapport in the beginning with Zoom. I mean, I think it's good to see a person's face to get a sense of them and to decide if they're, you know, their energy works with me such that I like them and I kind of want to work with them. You do a little bit of that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I certainly do. You know, every time I send a client an email, there's a link in the bottom of my email underneath in my signature block that allows them to click on. I use a fabulous app, which I'm sure many people are aware of, called Calendly. They can click on Calendly, you know, they can, and I should say Calendly is not getting a kickback. I'm not getting any money from Calendly, but just a 100% honest endorsement, you know, so clients can see my availability. Right from there, they can book a phone call or a Zoom call, whatever they prefer. Some clients don't want to see me, or maybe some clients don't want me to see them, but they still want to talk.
you know, Okay, so let's talk technology for a minute. I am a huge fan of Calendly as well. You've got to move quickly. And candidly, if you're trying to coordinate with someone and you send them dates, by the time they respond to you, things have changed. The dynamic nature of our business and our calendars, they have control over how they want to connect with you. I love it. And I was concerned at first that it would feel too impersonal. But as it turns out, if you've got a relationship with folks, the efficiency is really valued, right? And then you can be efficient and quick about making those appointments. And then one more question about this before we actually get the things we're supposed to be talking about today. So pre-COVID, when you were working remotely, was there a sense of, I don't know, you're not really the real deal because you're not in an office? Did you have any credibility challenges that, in my mind at least, have completely reversed today, such that people don't attach any value to that environment? How has that been for you?
You know, I don't think it was ever really a problem. Part of it is the fact that I'm old. I mean, we're talking here, I'm 52. So, you know, I was in my late, you know, I was 47 when I started my practice. Maybe if I would have been like 22 or 25, and I, you know, and of course, I still don't need to shave really. But, you know, if I were 25 years old and looked like I didn't even know what a razor was, you know, because I didn't have to, then maybe the credibility thing would have been more of a challenge. But the fact that I could say, hey, I've been a CPA for 20 years and, you know, I've got all this experience, I think that really helped, you know, negate any credibility issues on the front end. I don't know that was ever really an issue or a question.
Oh, very, very nice. Well, because I am a closet financial person, I love talking numbers. Me getting to talk to CPA, who happens to have an interest in economics, makes me really thrilled. I would love to, you know, listen to all you have to talk about relative to both. So you have a podcast. It's a natural, you're a natural expert for a podcast. People want to learn about finances and taxes and considerations for running their business. How did you get started and how's it been going for you?
Well, this is where I have to make a full disclosure. So I got started doing my podcast. I'm trying to remember how I got into it. It just seemed like something kind of fun to do. And I did I did maybe 12 to 15 episodes. And for a while I was doing about one a week. But then I got so busy and like so many things, it's like, well, you know, I'll get to that next week. And the next week becomes next month. And the next month becomes next quarter. And so full disclosure, I don't think I recorded a new podcast episode, even though you can still find it out there. I think it's just the Guidance Accounting Podcast. I don't think I recorded a new episode probably in about 14 months. I got so busy when, particularly when COVID hit. And then as we got deeper into COVID and we're trying to figure out what this PPP stuff is and these EIDL loans and EIDL grants, all these other programs that were coming at us a million miles a minute, I never really had a chance to catch my breath, step back and do what I actually, you know, advise and coach a lot of my clients to do, which is to look at the big picture. So yeah, it's, I guess maybe I'm a case of, you know, the cobbler's kids don't have shoes.
Well, you're too busy to teach because you're busy doing and serving. I mean, I get that. But you talk about the big picture. So let's talk about that for just a minute. Although I've known you, you know, since I've been at the organization here at the Chamber, I did take a look at your profile to realize that you have an economics degree. And so talking about the big picture, I'm a fan of macroeconomics and the really large trends relative to inflation and, you know, the big picture that shapes business. You are more of a fan of microeconomics. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference and why you're more interested in the micro?
Sure. So, you know, macro is just like it sounds, you know, big picture, looking at like national economy, global economy, international economics, looking at unemployment rates, inflation rates, et cetera, GDP. I'm old enough to remember when we used to call it GNP, gross national product, instead of gross domestic product. Yeah, that rings a bell. But again, you'd have to be like probably my age to remember that. But, you know, so that's macro. Micro is more concerned about decision making at the individual level or the business level. And so microeconomics, to me, when I was a student long time ago in the 90s, macroeconomics was looking at, you know, all these big trends, and it just seemed so hard to come to a positive conclusion. Whereas microeconomics was, well, if this company is going to produce, you know, and of course we would always have to graph everything, right? Being an economist. So you throw up a graph and you go, we're going to produce to the point where marginal revenue equals our marginal cost. That's right. Like the profit maximizing business behavior. But, you know, microeconomics really incorporates a lot of not just looking at statistics or statistical analysis, but even looking, it's kind of almost the intersection of econ and statistics and psychology and human behavior and organizational behavior. Mm. But so I was really a little more attracted to micro because I knew I always wanted to go into business of some sort. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of how I got how I landed on being more interested in micro. Macro, I just felt like we could never quite come to the right, you know, we had all these models. You've got the Keynesian model and the classical and the neoclassical economics models. And you've got the monetarists are out there. Anyway, I'm probably boring your listeners, so I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole.
Fascinating. So how has your interest in microeconomics applied? How has that perspective impacted your work with clients?
You know, I think how it impacts my work with clients is kind of where, I look at a particular small business client, but I'm trying to look at the larger economic environment. For example, I've got this one client, I love her to death. She's a fabulous person. She's a very successful realtor and real estate investor. And she doesn't need a lot of cash to run her business, but it's not unusual for her to have couple hundred thousand dollars literally just sitting in a checking account.
Wow.
And I'll tell her, and in fact this is a conversation we had probably about 6 weeks ago. Jane, you've got $200,000 sitting in your checking account earning 0.25% or maybe 0.5% interest. If inflation is 7%, you're going to lose probably $12,000 to $14,000 of purchasing power value by just having that much cash sitting there. Mm. And she'll go, oh, yeah, you're right. So in that case, I mean, I like to think that I was able to add some value to my client by saying, you know, move that money into something that's going to, you know, whether you think you want to go into a traditional inflation hedge like precious metals, you know, gold, silver, platinum, whatever, or real estate is another one. And of course, I should always throw out the caveat that I'm not giving investment advice. I'm not a licensed investment advisor by any means.
Right.
But I'm just, you know, want to point things out to people because so many of my small business clients, and my clients are typically solopreneurs on up to maybe the president, CEO of a small, maybe a 25 person company. Mm-hmm. And they're so busy wrapped up in the day-to-day operations, or maybe they're heavily involved in the sales side of the business that they don't really think about, oh, if I keep 200 grand in my checking account in our current inflationary environment, if that keeps up over a year, I may lose, $12,000 to $14,000 of purchasing power value. So it's like, okay, well, let's move that money. I mean, does that affect your lifestyle? Yeah, but I mean, it pays for a really nice vacation, or it's a down payment on a car, or it's a good chunk you might put towards a kid's college, tuition bill. So,
that's fascinating. So it sounds to me like you work with your clients beyond the tax season.
Oh, yeah.
You work with them throughout the year. I mean, that's, I didn't know that.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, Doing tax returns in a timely manner, making estimated tax payments. That's kind of, if you'll pardon the sports analogy, it's kind of like basic blocking and tackling if you think of football. But beyond that, there's so much more. And this is the complaint that I hear oftentimes when people come to work with me coming from another CPA is they feel like their CPA really wasn't available to give them advice, or they didn't really tell them what to do beyond sign here and this is how much you need to pay in tax. Mm-hmm. And I feel, you know, I mean, I don't want to just be the tax guy. I want to be the small business advisor. Now, you know, I'm not a business coach per se. I'm not going to tell someone, you know, how they should run their business, but I certainly want to give them tips and, you know, actionable, items that they can act on throughout the year. And so that's one of the reasons, you know, I bill my clients. I don't bill. If somebody says, what's your hourly rate? My answer is, I'm not sure. Because I typically bill clients on a flat monthly fee. And so that flat monthly fee covers, you know, what we agreed to on the front end, which is, you know, preparing your tax return and tax planning and, you know, coaching you on making estimated tax payments. But it also includes, you know, effectively unlimited phone calls and emails, because I don't want somebody to work with me and then they get a, whether it's a letter from the IRS or potential really good business opportunity, and they're like, well, I should maybe run this by Nels, but you know what, if I do, you know, if he writes a letter to the IRS or we spend an hour talking through something, I'm probably going to get a bill for, you know, a couple $100. I don't want somebody to feel like they're being nickel and dime to death. I want someone to feel like, I want clients to feel like they have an ongoing relationship. And I don't mean to get off on the self-promotion diatribe.
Well, you didn't. It's very helpful, because I will tell you, so I read a book years and years ago called The E-Myth Revisited, right?
Yes.
Mind-blowing book when you think about the small
Michael
business.
Gerber.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. So together, we're going to make a whole brain here. This is very cool. Thank you.
That's right. Simple.
So in the book, the concept of when you start a business, you bring your, there are three different ways you approach it. You're the technician like you, you were a CPA at a company and you started your own business as a CPA. The technical skills, you have a business mind. I want to go buy a business because I want to run a company. I like business. And then the third version is the entrepreneur, which is I'm going to create something, right? Do I have those three categories right?
I think you nailed it.
Okay. But we can't, and the message was typically if you're a business owner, if you're lucky, you have two of those three things. Never three. Well, never. Listen to me. It's not normal. It's not usual for a business owner to have all three. So what you need are professional partners like a CPA. And the other thing I wanted to say before I ask you some questions about this idea that one of my learnings when I started running this organization is this idea that you work in your business.
Mm-hmm.
And you work on your business. And the balance of those two is really important, because if you got your head too much in the weeds, you're not driving the ship, you know, directing the ship, as it were. So back to you then. I have a very close relationship with my accountant. We are on the phone regularly, because if you've got to have a good handle on your finances in order to create direction for your organization. So you said earlier, the president of a manufacturing company is working on those widgets, and he or she is not thinking about some of the things that you're talking about. How have you experienced that with the clients you work with?
So you mean how do I work on widgets or try not to work on widgets, or how do my clients do that?
How do you help your clients when they're working in the business? And I know I gave you quite of a fuzzy question there. Working in the business versus on the business, and how the role you play in that and guide them so that they can, you know, be focused on the right things when they need to be.
Sure. Yeah. You know, one thing I talk with a lot of my clients about, you know, a lot of people, we have the, you know, a lot of people would say that the American dream is to own your own home. There are a lot of other people that would say the American dream is to own your own business, whatever that looks like or whatever shape or form that takes. But so many people start a business and they just want to work for themselves, but they don't necessarily have goals. Well, I mean, they might have financial goals, but what's the end goal for the business? I mean, are you the business? So if something happens to you, your business just kind of evaporates or goes away, or are you building an organization, or are you building, you know, a client list, something that you can, I know this sounds kind of crass, but that you can monetize when you decide to retire, or maybe you have a health challenge and you decide you're going to not do that business or work in that line of business anymore. What's the exit strategy is usually what I ask my clients. Okay, you're going to start this business, or maybe you started 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Maybe you started it and you were 40. Now you're 55. What's your exit strategy? I don't know. I mean, could you sell your business to a competitor? A cousin of mine was a good attorney. He was practicing solo. When he decided to retire, he literally just turned the lights off and walked out. He didn't sell a client list. You know, he didn't have any, he really didn't have an exit strategy except just to kind of turn everything off. Now, if he would have found a junior person that he could kind of groom, and then he could sell the book of business to that he developed over, you know, 40 years of legal practice, he'd be in a better, I mean, I think he's left in a good financial situation, but he'd be in an even better financial situation. So, you know, that's one question I ask clients a lot. What's your exit strategy? And the answer I almost always get is, I haven't really thought about that.
And it doesn't matter. Well, I just wanted to show you. You can be great at business and you need experts like you to help you refine and fill in the spots where you haven't considered things. Ask those questions to make them think and kind of really round out their portfolio of expertise.
Right. Yeah. A good accountant, a good attorney, a good insurance person, a good financial planner. Those are all professionals. I think sometimes certain ones are undervalued or not appreciated.
Yeah. I agree. Well, so as you talk to your clients, now I'd like to move into giving us some advice, Nels, because you are working with small businesses all the time. You have your own thoughts. You hear what your clients are saying. And what are your clients identifying as their top priorities right now? And what are you wanting to make sure are their top priorities in 2022 and moving forward?
So for my clients, I would say the top priorities that I'm seeing is working with our current environment, I would say, of uncertainty. So in my experience, that's the thing that business owners probably, I don't know if fear is the right word, but that keeps them up at night is not knowing, are we in a higher inflationary environment? Interest rates are probably going to go up to try to cure that inflationary environment. Unemployment, you know, what's going to happen there? And so I think when businesses are doing their budgeting, they're always trying to look ahead and anticipate or crystal ball what the next 12 to 24 months are going to look like. And right now, you know, the last 2 years, we've been in this crazy period of flux. Where, you know, in March 2020, I mean, some of us thought the sky was falling.
Yeah.
We didn't know. I had successful real estate investors and real estate agent clients that, you know, were used to making, you know, strong six-figure income. And all of a sudden they had three or four closings or deals put on hold for about 6 weeks because everyone wanted to sit on their hands and see what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And then, well, we know at least locally what happened with real estate. It just continued to go up, up, and up. If you were a buyer, you realize that, you know, painfully. And if you were a seller that didn't have to buy, you realize that, wow, I just made a ton of money on selling my second home or my investment property, whatever. But I think that uncertainty is what keeps my clients awake at night. And so what I try to help them with is, let's just have, plan A, plan B, and plan C. So plan A, if we're still in, if we think we're still dealing with high inflation, we probably don't, as I mentioned, earlier, we probably don't want to hold on to a lot of cash. Because cash is a wasting asset. It's a terrible store of value. If you are a business that carries inventory, we want to look at, is your inventory something that appreciates or depreciates? If you're a restaurant, you already know this. You there's very little that you want to buy and hold on to for more than maybe even a couple of weeks. You want to have really high turnover on your inventory. If you're a car dealership or a used auto dealership, what we've seen the last couple of years, particularly with supply chain issues, your inventory is probably going up in value, unless you've got that classic, 1985 Yugo that nobody
even knows are looking pretty interesting.
And right, those might be looking pretty interesting. What are we paying, 4 1/4 for a gallon of gas? Yeah. So, you know, it really depends on what your business is doing. You know, if you're in construction, you know, you're probably your biggest challenge is labor. You know, whether it's employee labor or whether it's subcontractor labor, where you've got maybe you're a general contractor and you've got subs that come in and do all the roofing or, you know, do all the concrete work or do all the framing for whatever kind of building you're putting up. So it really depends from time to time. And, you know, gosh, the other thing is, if you can get discounts from your vendors, if you've got a vendor that will offer you a 2% discount if you pay within 10 days, as opposed to no discount if you pay after 10 days, you know, maybe that 2% looks pretty darn attractive right now if you have the cash flow to support making those payments right away. And then that's a matter of making sure you've got a good AP, you know, accounts payable system in place so that you can take advantage of those vendor discounts.
I will tell you, I'm thinking it, reflecting back on the Great Recession. So I used to be a financial advisor. I was a Dane Rauscher before I got into St. Paul. And I was there right before the Great Recession. And I stayed in touch with some of my friends over there during that season. And the panic we saw, even when I was at the Port Authority, a colleague of mine liquidated his entire retirement portfolio during the Great Recession. And for our listeners, and Nels and I are looking at each other like, oh my gosh, you know, if there's one message you can give to folks in uncertain times is to breathe, right? Don't make an emotional decision because typically if your emotions are high, when you're uncertain, you're not going to make the best decision. Then you call your CPA and you call your advisor and your attorney and your insurance person. You say, help me be logical and thoughtful about the fact that I'm feeling panicky right now. So I cautioned him with all that I had that, you know, don't make an emotional decision, but he was afraid. He was approaching retirement. He didn't know what the future was. It's all well and good for us to talk about a 40-year span in the stock market. It's all well and good to talk about the appreciation and value of my home. I am retiring soon and I am afraid.
Right.
So when you say uncertainty, takes me back to that place. And that is a real and it is a powerful, sometimes hard to resist, powerful emotion, that fear.
Absolutely. And if any of the listeners are feeling like they're on the ledge and they're about to, you know, make a jump that they may regret, call your financial planner, call your CPA, call somebody that can help talk you off the ledge.
Yes.
You know, in one of my favorite business books, which maybe is a little dated now because it's probably 40 years old, Swim with the Sharks by Harvey McKay. You know, there was a chapter in there that the title of the chapter was, if you make decisions with your heart, you're going to wind up with heart disease. And, nice. I think it's kind of akin to, you know, don't make those rash decisions, you know, try to make more measured decisions, have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C.
And yes, making quick decisions perhaps allows you to capitalize on the front end of a change. But if you had to choose between too quick and too slow certainly has a lot lower risk profile for loss, crash and burn, et cetera. So I tend to fall on the path of let's sleep on it. Let's have a wait for the emotions to settle down. So you can really be, it's like a cloud. You got to wait for clear skies before you make a decision and create a path forward, because there isn't only one path forward, right? There's multiple ways that you could move forward even in the midst of a really challenging environment. And so it's not like you have to come to one right decision and go. There's time for thoughtfulness. On that note, you're a business owner. So how have you done, not only in serving your clients, but as a small business owner yourself, how have these last years been for you? What are some successes or even failures you've dealt with? We don't often talk about failures to one another as teaching moments, but I like them. But how about you?
Well, you know, one of the things I learned, I'm a people pleaser by nature. And so it's very difficult for me to say no. And I think also as an entrepreneur, for a lot of us entrepreneurs, it's hard to say no, because we're always for, you know, lack. And again, it's kind of a crass way of saying it, but, you know, a lot of us will chase every nickel and dime we can. So I've, you know, I've learned that, you know, if a nonprofit approaches me and needs tax or accounting or bookkeeping help, I don't have good, strong nonprofit experience. I just need to say no. You know, certain industries, I would be doing the client or potential client a disservice to say, yes, I'll work with them, because, you know, I'll get clients or potential clients will be referred to me all the time. And I'm probably to the point where I probably say, you know, after an initial conversation, I'd love to be able to help you, but I don't feel like we're going to be the best fit for, you know, one of a dozen different reasons. And so, you know, I think during COVID, because I mentioned earlier, you know, I charge on this flat monthly fee model. And so when, you know, PPP came out and all of a sudden the EIDL program, which had been around for many, many years, but it really wasn't applicable to any of my clients. And now all of a sudden it's applicable to all of my clients. You know, there was so much learning and figuring out and then doing, you know, let's get this stuff in place. Let's get the paperwork done. And I felt like I would be like a war profiteer if I would have charged extra for that extra work I was doing. And so I, you know, in 2020 and 2021 in particular, I did a lot more work those years than what I was actually getting paid for. And so, you know, it's like, okay, but I also realized that even if I wouldn't have taken on any more clients, I was doing so much more work. And then that prevented me from getting to, you know, all my clients in a timely manner. So that also was a lesson in that I need to really control my workload and, you know, who I'm working with, because I don't have the time to go, even if a company seems really cool, I don't have the time to go learn that industry or learn all the ins and outs for a particular business. You know, it's, I'm at the stage where, you know, they're probably really about six different companies I work with. They might have different names, but they're probably playing in the same or similar sandbox. So, you know, so I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel there all the time.
So on that note, what comes to mind for me is, you know, the when to say no. I find myself in a similar, I have a similar personality. And in my job at the chamber, what I've got is a fabulous board and I use them. And I am inclined to say yes too easily. And, you know, we've created this entirely separate line of business, hiring out our professional services to other like mission aligned organizations. And so it's, how do you price it appropriately and such that it's a reasonable and yet you're not growing yourself out of business, right? And if you're a yes person, you're inclined to work, as you just said, too many hours, you're not getting enough money. So talk to me about your perspective on boards. I turn to my board and I'm very intentional with them. Here's my heart in this situation. I need your head to balance that, to make help me make wise decisions for this organization such that the organization grows with or without me, right? Like it needs to be about the organization itself growing and we need to make wise decisions now about committing resources to make sure that continues outside of, I like you, I want to help you. And so I'll do it all for free. You know, there's got to be that balance. What are your thoughts on boards for small organizations? And do you use one?
So the first part of your question, I think boards can be great. I think that when you bring, you know, if you're putting together, whether it's a more formal board or whether it's a more informal board of advisors, there's actually a local author, Jim Zugschwert, who wrote a book, and the name is escaping me now, but it's basically about putting together a personal board of advisors. And it doesn't even have to be, you don't even necessarily need to be an entrepreneur. It can be just a board of advisors to help guide you through your career, you know, and most of the time you don't necessarily want to have family members on the board, you know. And Jim Zugschwert, his experience was his dad went out and got I think three or four individuals who are unrelated, who are older, but kind of staggered, you know, when he was maybe, I don't know, in his mid to late 20s, so that everyone had a little bit different perspective in terms of different organizational experiences and such. But I think boards can be tremendously valuable. The one thing I would caution, whether you're just somebody with a more traditional corporate career trajectory or somebody with a for-profit or non-for-profit organization that you're running, is when you're putting together a board, you want to make really, really sure that your board members really understand what you and or your organization do. Mm-hmm. Because if they don't, I think then their feedback or their input isn't going to be as valuable, mm-hmm. and it could almost be at cross purposes. I've seen, I've seen a couple of nonprofit organizations put together boards, and I think I've seen people on those boards, maybe they were friends of the founder or the individual, mm-hmm. but they didn't really know what the organization did. And so it was, they were almost taking up space in a way, mm-hmm. And sometimes not in a good way. Mm-hmm. And so,
but that's really insightful, really insightful. And the book by Jim Zugschwert is Peak Perspective.
Thank you. Yeah. Jim is actually a former neighbor of mine. And in fact, funny story about Jim, he's probably in his early 60s now. And full disclosure, he lives in Blaine, but up until probably a year and a half ago, he had spent his entire life living in the city of St. Paul, grew up in Highland Park, went to St. Thomas, then went to work for the family business, which was in St. Paul, lived his starter home he bought in, the mid late 80s, had four kids there, never moved out.
Wow.
So he spent 60 plus years living in the borders of St. Paul.
Oh, he's somebody I might want to invite to speak.
He would be a great, and he is effectively a professional speaker. He's a friend, a former neighbor, and I know he has actually done paid and unpaid speaking engagements. He's a fabulous person and a fabulous speaker. And I think he could add a lot of value to your listeners and listeners of the podcast for sure.
Huh. Jim Zuckerberg. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. So how would an interested business owner find you?
So an interest, probably the best thing to do is to, a number of ways they can find me. My website is guidanceaccounting.com, www.guidanceaccounting.com. My email address is my first name. Granted, it's an unusual first name, Nels, just like Nelson without the O-N. So it's N-E-L-S at guidanceaccounting.com. Or if you wanted to, you can pick up the phone and give me a call. 612-618-5299.
Awesome.
I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. I've got clients to text me, and if I'm not available, I'll just say, hey, I can't talk right now, but
check out Calendly and we can get some time on the calendar.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. If somebody emails me, I can email them back. They can get them. And actually I think there's even like a request for a meeting on my website. They can send, like a contact form, like a type form, something.
People can
reach out. So, but this is really about the chamber. I don't look at this as self-promotion. I look at this because to me, and I don't know, I apologize if I'm preempting a question you were going to ask. When I started my practice 5 years ago, I had time and no money. And the chamber for me was just it's been a tremendous community asset for longer than you and I have been around and will be around. Does it predate the state of Minnesota?
By 10 years, we were a state in 1858. We became a chamber in 1868. So we're certainly the oldest chamber in the state, which makes sense in the capital city, but no, we started 10 years after the state.
There you go. Okay. And I think if I'm keeping my facts straight, for like a geographic based chamber, are we the largest chamber in the state? In terms of membership, I suppose you have to exclude the Minnesota chamber because I think, Minnesota chamber covers the whole state.
But, and by revenue we are. by revenue. Okay. Because members, that's a slippery slope of how people count. But if you look at revenue, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the St. Paul Chamber, and I know we say St. Paul, but it's really the East Metro Chamber.
St. Paul area, right?
Yeah,
right.
St. Paul area. Thank you. St. Paul area chamber. And I know all kinds of people that do business in Woodbury and Lake Elmo, you know, Maplewood, Roseville, et cetera. And whenever I'm working with somebody who is starting a business from scratch, I tell them, depending where they're located, I say, check out your local chamber. And if you're in the East Metro, check out the St. Paul area chamber. But there are so many ways to be involved, and it doesn't matter if you're a solopreneur like myself or a lot of my clients, or if you're an Ecolab or a Wells Fargo or a U.S. Bank or a Baker Tilly, you know, my right. my former firms. Right. You know, there's the chamber has so much to offer. You know, for me, I found that I was, you know, I would go to gatherings, formal and informal, related to the chamber. And often I was the only CPA there. And so all of a sudden someone's got a tax question. Okay, so now we start talking about taxes or bookkeeping right. or accounting or whatever the case may be. You know, and sometimes those conversations turned into client relationships and sometimes they didn't. But I mean, I'm a huge believer in karma. I mean, I'd rather give an awful lot for free than, you know, charge for everything and be miserly with my, you know, time and talent, such as it is. So,
you know, I just couldn't agree more, you know, the yes, good people be, and frankly, in this market, you don't have the luxury of not being a good people because we're yes. simply too connected. And, right. you know, we interestingly enough too, you know, almost 30% of our businesses are from outside of the East Metro.
Oh,
you know, our message is if you care about the politics, the advocacy, the development, the ecosystem of the East Metro, you're involved. And frankly, as the Metro goes, you know, so goes so much of the state relative to activity, economy, energy, the whole deal. So, I mean, there's a lot of good reasons to invest in chambers. And so I appreciate your story of, yes, we have the largest companies in the world and we have companies like yours that started out and there's room for everybody at the table, as it were. So I'm glad Absolutely. To know that it's been valuable to you as well. Well, we've run out of time. No, you know, we could keep talking. And so when we're done with this, you and I are going to have a long conversation about microeconomics. Y'all should know that's coming soon.
Fair enough.
But I want to thank you again for chatting with me. We appreciate your time and all your organization and the fact that you have been so involved in the chamber, bringing your good energy into the community is so valuable. So thank you for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, Bea. Thanks so much for inviting me, having me.
So thanks to all of you for joining us for Bea's Table Talk. We have more conversations in the weeks ahead, speaking to more fascinating business leaders like Nels and learning about how their companies are adapting to this new normal and what's ahead in our economy. So thanks to all, and we will see you in the trenches.